This week on the Allegheny Front, climate change isn't just a headline from a scientific journal or a buzzword in the current political fray. It's affecting real people in their everyday lives. From coal miners.
I don't think anybody wants to see anything bad happen to the planet. It's just touchy subjects, you know, especially when it's somebody's livelihood.
To migrants leaving their farms and families behind to find jobs.
You don't know if you're ever going to see them again. It's very hard.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. Join us for stories about the people and even the wildlife feeling the heat of climate change. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We make small-scale weather decisions all the time. Do I really need an umbrella today? A sweater? Maybe just stay inside. And if you're like me, you're never really 100% sure you've made the right call. But as the climate continues to change, people are making bigger decisions with the weather in mind. They're thinking about ending careers, selling a house, or leaving a country or a culture behind. Two brothers are making that kind of choice. Julia Kamari-Drapkin brings us their story from New Orleans.
Noel and Alcaldia Martinez are two brothers in a family of 15. The brothers are close. They talk on the phone almost every day. And lately, there's a conversation they've been having over and over again. They're talking about whether it's better to leave or better to stay in their home country of Honduras. So far, they've made opposite choices. Alcaldia stayed, Noel left. Let's start with Noel's side of all of this. I first met Noel here in New Orleans, at work in a basement apartment in Broadmoor, a neighborhood that some thought better to abandon after Hurricane Katrina. He and three other men are working on a day when most people went home early because of flooding. A river of moisture from Central America that meteorologists nicknamed the Mayan Express has been hosing down New Orleans with rain. But Noel tells me, back in Honduras, there hasn't been enough work because there hasn't been enough rain for a long time. Noel and his family are from a tiny town in the central Honduran state of Yoro, surrounded by big pine tree forests. And every year, people there wait for the May rains to plant their fields and feed their animals. And when the rains do come to Yoro, people say it rains so hard, it rains fish. They post cell phone videos online to try and prove it really happens. Like this one from 2012, with children celebrating in the bright red mud with tiny fish in their hands on the side of the road. But for the past 4 years and counting, it's been abnormally dry. And not just in Noel's hometown. Across Central America, less rain has been falling later. And it's been hot. Temperature records keep breaking. That's made it hard for farmers like Noel. Staple crops like corn and beans and exports like coffee and bananas have been failing from fungus, pests, and drought. The pattern is precisely what climate change models predict for the region as global temperatures rise. An estimated 3.5 million people are without food. Twice that many are out of work. When Noel lost his bean crop, he couldn't find work that paid enough in any Honduran cities. So he made a decision. He'd cross the border. Come to the U.S. You probably heard a lot about Central American migrants. Children crossing the border alone, families moving in record numbers. And you probably also heard people say they are refugees from violence. And they are. But violence and the drought that brought Noel north, they're connected. Because droughts put so many people out of work, research tells us climate change undermines security. Desperate people turn to crime, turn on each other, turn to other countries. Beneath it all, climate is an invisible, constant force. As Noel crossed the border, the rest of his family stayed. The brother I mentioned at the beginning, Alcaldio, he stayed because he had a job. He was a milkman at a dairy. A job that was supposed to be more stable from one season to the next, unlike farming. But things were tough. Another brother, who also stayed, was murdered.
He was a farmer, and they just stole what he had on him and killed him. All of this leads people to crime, I don't know, as a way to make easy money.
Noel got the news when he was still crossing the border. He wanted to go home for the funeral, but his family told him to keep going. Both the drought and the violence back home were getting worse. Noel calls his brother almost every night from his work sites here in New Orleans. They talk, but sometimes it seems like they're talking right past each other. Now that Noel is here in the U.S. and Alcaldio is there in Honduras, each yearns for what the other brother has. They wish they could switch places. Noel's been here 2.5 years now, working for a better life. But now, more than anything, he wants to return home. Noel renovates empty houses for 12, sometimes 14 hours. Days are long and lonely. He hasn't seen his 5 children or his wife since he got in the car and left them behind 3 years ago.
You don't know if you're ever going to see them again. It's very hard.
Noel pulls out his cell phone. With a paint-encrusted finger, he plays voicemails from his youngest daughters, ages 3 and 8. They heard that Dad hurt his hand on a drill, so they tell him to come home so they can heal him. But you really don't need to speak Spanish to understand what they're saying. Noel doesn't want to live like this, raising his family with a cell phone. He has plans to go back someday, but it's hard to make the leap now that everyone's dependent on the money he's making here. This is what Noel keeps telling his brother. Supporting the family here means risking never seeing them again there. But despite hearing all of this, the loneliness, the dusk to dawn work, how much Noel misses home life in Honduras, Alcaldio insists he still wants to come.
He keeps telling me, you're no longer here, so I'm leaving too. But it's something you have to think hard about. I tell him he's crazy for wanting to come here.
Alcaldio isn't just missing his brother. Last year, the dairy where Alcaldio was working fired everybody. Without rain, there's no pasture. The cows were starving, so they sold them all for meat. By April, the only work Alcaldio could find was guarding wood in the lumber yards, a job created by extreme heat. It caused southern bark beetle populations to explode. They devoured the pine tree forests across Honduras. The only way to stop it is to cut down the trees, use them for lumber. They even called in the army to help. Now, guarding beetle-infested lumber every night for work makes Alcaldio anxious. But Noel is urging him to be patient.
I told him, you wait. I'm going to see how things are.
The last week in April, I called Alcaldio myself to see how he was doing. And I honestly expected to hear it was all terrible. But just minutes before, Alcaldio told me it rained. Nobody in town was expecting it.
We looked at each other in shock. We looked at the sky and we couldn't guess rain was coming. And suddenly the rain fell hard. Hard for about 10 minutes nonstop. The land got wet and we got happy because it calmed the dust. It cleared the smoke in the air. The animals that were sad from thirst and heat got happy as well. Horses, cows, pigs, lambs.
Happy animals, happy people. Awesome, right? I asked Alcaldio, so now what? How does the rain change the situation? While the rain might have changed Alcaldio's job prospects, it still hasn't changed Alcaldio's desire to come to the U.S. That lumber he was guarding, it came from pine trees that are actually pretty essential to the longer-term rain patterns. Now that they're gone, thanks to the beetles, thanks to extreme heat, Alcaldio worries his hometown is becoming a desert.
We are rationing water. 2 hours in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. It's not enough to fill the water tanks. In the desert, there are no trees. Everything is barren. There is no shadow, no animals. It's all barren. No deer, no snakes, no other animals. It is like nature is no longer there. It is destroyed.
And right there, I realize that Alcaldio, just like a scientist would have, has laid out for me the difference between today's weather and tomorrow's climate. Today's single storm, this one season's sigh of relief, can't erase the longer-term risks of living in an unstable climate. Back in New Orleans, Noel still dreams about returning to Honduras. In 7 years, he says, he plans to buy a house again. But his wife thinks he'll never come back. Still, Noel works hard to stay connected. When the kids don't want to talk, he sends videos of the storms in New Orleans.
I sent them a video showing them, look how much it's raining. And my wife says, here, we can't even bear this heat anymore. We're burning.
There's the illusion that a right choice can be made here. One that will make the two brothers happy, make their family happy. But as they eye each other across the border, as much as they can see all the ways the other one got it right, they can also see all the ways the other one got it wrong. Any choice comes with a cost. Floods one place, drought another. Loneliness here, poverty there. As the climate changes, the conversation goes on. Two brothers making choices that are really no choice at all. For WBEZ, I'm Julia Kamari-Drapkin.
That story was produced in collaboration with WBEZ in Chicago and IC Change, a community climate and weather journal. There are a lot more stories about climate change at our website. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. To help us tell better stories about how weather and climate change are affecting our region, we partnered with IC Change. That's the community weather and climate project you just heard about. It's kind of an online almanac where regular people share their observations or questions about what they see outside, what's going on around them. This summer, I had a question that I posted there. Why am I seeing so many dragonflies in Pittsburgh? I mean, sitting in the middle of traffic, two were mating on my car windshield. I don't remember seeing anything like it before, so I consulted an expert.
My name is Dennis McNair. I'm a retired biology professor from the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown.
A restored wetland in Bedford County is his window into the world of dragonflies, where he has 20 years of data.
Well, there are a lot of answers to your question. One of them is when people start seeing things, no matter what it is, you know, smart cars or whatever, once you've seen one, you start seeing others.
Okay, but could there maybe be another reason?
The other thing is this was a droughty summer, and the dragonflies maybe had warmer water that they were developing in. They spend most of their life actually in the larval stage in the water.
Now we're getting somewhere. They even overwinter on the water, only leaving to mate. McNair says dragonflies eat mosquitoes and other bugs, which have also done well this summer. So maybe the early spring and warm summer caused more of them to take to the wing. Maybe. McNair says it's not exactly surprising to see dragonflies in Pittsburgh, with its three rivers and all. He says, of course, different species have different habitat needs, but I didn't get a great ID.
If I had to guess and you told me that you saw a dragonfly of unknown species in a parking lot or along a street, I'd guess it was a wandering glider because they wander around a lot. Others, the ones that come out in this time of year, especially meadowhawks, the little red ones, they capture insects out over vegetation. And there are some that even migrate. Some of our large darners, they will migrate in the fall, kind of like birds. They aggregate in large numbers someplace, and then they'll move as a group, sometimes hundreds of miles.
South, north, where do they go?
We're still finding that out. And one of the first questions you asked me was, has climate change have anything to do with more dragonflies in Pittsburgh or something? We've found dragonflies in Bedford County, for instance, that have a more southern distribution generally. Carolina saddlebags and mocha emeralds are usually found down in Virginia and the Carolinas. It's not that they were never found in Bedford County, but they were found very sparsely, and we found more of them than we would anticipate. But it'll take many more years and many more observers before we know for sure that they've changed, they've shifted their range.
McNair's been fascinated with insects since he was a kid. He's seen about 60 species of dragonflies and smaller damselflies in Bedford County over the years. They're in the Odonata group, but check out some of their common names. Azure bluet, citrine forktail, fawn darner.
One of the reasons that they have a lay name like darner is if you watch the females, they'll go along over the surface of the water in many species and stick their abdomen down into the water like an old sewing machine. My grandmother told me when I was a little boy that if I told a lie, the dragonflies would come and darn my mouth shut.
That might have given me nightmares. But McNair says that long, slender abdomen doesn't sting. So I didn't have to roll up the windows of my car to keep the dragonflies out. But he says if I really want to get to the bottom of what I saw this summer, I'll have to get braver, buy a beginner's guide, and become a better observer. And that's why we're partnering with I See Change, to get more people to pay closer attention to the world around them, and to add to that body of knowledge about dragonflies, or birds, or rain patterns. I See Change is a way for anyone to investigate how weather and climate change might be affecting our environment. And they have an app. You can download it at iTunes, or just go to iseechange.org to begin. There's also more at our website, including fun dragonfly facts that retired professor Dennis McNair shared with me. And of course, photos. That's all at AlleghenyFront.org. And if you've also noticed more dragonflies this summer, could you let me know on Twitter? I'm at Kara Holsoppel. This is the Allegheny Front. In Appalachia, we know coal. We have a long history with it. But did you know that southern Illinois produces so much coal, it's sometimes called the Saudi Arabia of coal? No kidding. The coal industry has shaped whole towns in Illinois, defined them. One place like that is called West Frankfort. Coal has, of course, been pulled into the climate change fight. And West Frankfort and the people who live around there have also been dragged in, right along with coal. So recently, some people there decided they were going to mount an army against the so-called war on coal. WBEZ's Dan Weissman reports.
Every year, the town of West Frankfort literally throws a party in honor of the coal industry. It's called the Old King Coal Festival. And if you want to understand the intense relationship between this place, southern Illinois, and coal, it is all on display right here. This is it, the Old King Coal Festival 2016. It is Friday before sunset, colored lights, smell of funnel cake, sound of carnival rides, and wandering the Midway in her tiara and sash, Jamie Harmon, the winner of this year's Princess Flame pageant.
Hi.
Are you Princess Flame?
I am.
I've been looking for you. I'm Dan White.
Not much time to chat. She's about to help introduce the evening's entertainment. Down an alley lined with booths, the Lions Club selling lemonade, local hot sauce entrepreneur, information stand for black lung disease. The princess pauses to acknowledge a little admirer.
Oh, hi. They're like, oh my gosh, she's looking at me. Hi.
Then up the steps in her wood-soled high-heeled sandals to the stage, where she waves to the crowd, helps bring on the night's first band. I ask Princess Flame later about her connection to coal. I'm thinking she might have close ties.
Both of my grandfathers passed away before I got to meet them, before I was born, and they are both coal miners.
So it's like a connection to the past.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. This is my connection to them.
And that's about it. Two grandfathers she never even met. And as paper thin as that connection is, it's more than her friends have.
I mean, honestly, I don't think a lot of people around here realize that this is about coal. They know that it's Old King Coal Festival, but even like my friends are like, why is it called that? You know, it's, I don't know.
It actually makes sense that Princess Flame has barely any connection to the coal industry, the empire her crown stands for, because over the last 75 years, more than 85% of the coal mining jobs in Illinois have gone away. And just to be clear, that is not because of regulations or environmentalists or because the coal ran out. It's because the industry replaced the human workers with machines. In 2014, Illinois actually produced more coal than it did 75 years ago, even with all those jobs gone. And yet, the bond between West Frankfort and coal still runs deep. Because there's 19-year-old Jamie Harmon, and there's also people like Jack McReynolds. Jack's 80 years old, worked 40 of them underground. When Jack was a kid, people in West Frankfort kept track of time from the mine whistles. And his stories about this place are all about coal mining. And his coal mining stories are all horror stories. They're war stories. In 1951, when Jack was 15, an explosion underground killed more than 100 guys.
I've seen some of the bodies. They brought them to the gym at the school. I mean, it looked like bodies you would see in a combat area overseas. Limbs blowed off, heads blowed off.
Another story is from 1922, before Jack was born. A local operator tried running a mine with non-union labor. union men broke in.
Went inside this non-union mine, took all the workers out and executed them.
Jack's grandpa took his daughters out to see the bodies.
And my mother said, he pointed and said, girls, there's the vermin that tried to take the food off your table. My mother never forgot that.
People like Jack fought for these jobs, died for them, and coal mining defines the place they're from. It is the story they tell themselves about who they are. And if Jack represents the proud past of coal mining here, and Jamie Harmon is the future, Dave Diaz is living in its humbled present. He's 34, worked in coal mines for 11 years, and he's actually kind of down to earth about the realities of coal and pollution.
I don't think anybody wants to see anything bad happen to the planet. I mean, I'm not sitting there like, hey, pollution, you know what I mean? I'm not, you know, it's not like that. It's just, it's touchy subjects, you know, especially when it's somebody's livelihood.
Dave's a single dad, his son's 8, and he says he felt really lucky holding a job in a coal mine where he says he made more than $100,000 a year.
There's not many jobs that are competitive like that down here in Southern Illinois. I mean, that compete with the wages that you make at a coal mine.
But then, in February, Dave was laid off. It's been tough.
I've applied for the railroads. I applied for jobs out of state, which I didn't really want to do that because I don't want to leave my family. You know what I mean? I know my son doesn't. You know, he'd be really mad at me if I had to move away from everybody.
Now, imagine being Dave, waiting, hoping for that good-paying mining job to come back, looking around at the really not that great alternatives, and hearing a presidential candidate say something like this.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business.
I mean, God, have some compassion. She just comes out and flat out says she's going to destroy your life. You know what I mean? It's just like, geez, you know, have a little bit of a soul. You know what I mean?
The relationship between West Frankfort and coal is all of this. It's Jamie and Jack. And Dave, it's grim and nostalgic and fading and visceral and very loyal, very proud. And it is out of that relationship that a fledgling movement recently sprang up, a movement that felt like something new enough. I went to Southern Illinois to see it firsthand. In February, when a local mine laid off a bunch of people, including Dave, a guy named Bob Sandage, a guy who's worked in mines for 40 years, was sitting at home with his wife, Kelly.
She's the one that said, hey, we need to do something. Let's launch a Facebook page.
They called their page the Coal Miners Movement, and the message was, stop the war on coal. Now again, the big war on coal mining jobs was a technological war, and it's over. Almost all the jobs have been gone for a long time. But with every proposed regulation, every layoff, almost everybody who's still connected to this industry feels like their way of life, their identity, their integrity is under assault. So that was the message. Stop the war on coal. Bob and Kelly Sandage launched this Facebook group on a Saturday.
Man, it exploded.
People started liking the page. 100, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000. By just Monday morning, they had 13,000 Facebook likes and a DC lobbying consultant suddenly on the phone offering to volunteer his time to help the cause. To the lobbyist, to me, to Bob and Kelly, felt like maybe they were suddenly mounting an army, a groundswell of people ready to take up a fight for their way of life. And for weeks, momentum is building. The organizers of the Old King Coal Festival came calling, inviting Bob and Kelly to lead a rally at the festival. They offered Bob and Kelly 90 minutes on the festival stage, a chance to turn that online groundswell into a real-life crowd.
In the membership, you get a newsletter twice
at the festival, I stick pretty close to Bob and Kelly. And Friday night, after meeting the princess, I hang out at the booth that Bob and Kelly had set up across from the Lions Club lemonade stand to sign people up for the coal miners movement.
Membership's free.
One by one, he gets a few dozen email addresses, some encouragement. At one point, a kid, maybe 10 years old, comes up to offer him a silent fist bump.
You're the man.
Next day, Saturday, festival's big day, rally day. Bob and Kelly ride in a parade at 1 o'clock behind Princess Flame on the back of a convertible, also Teen Princess Flame and Preteen Princess Flame and various princess runners-up, each on the back of her own convertible. And then 3 o'clock, time for the rally. The stage sits at one end of the festival ground, facing a parking lot for the local Moose Lodge. This is it. I've come to West Frankfort envisioning this huge crowd. Former miners like Jack McReynolds, laid-off miners like Dave Diaz, their families, kids, grandkids. But now that it's time for Bob and Kelly to fire up their rally, It is actually unclear what exactly they should do because nobody's there. Nobody. The stage faces a completely empty parking lot.
We need to round up people.
How do you do that?
I don't know.
What they do is hang out by their booth, getting antsier, like this must all be some kind of mistake. This goes on for like a half an hour. They do their best to keep cool, hoping things will turn around.
I'm gonna give it a few more minutes. Know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Until finally, Bob and Kelly and the friend Mike all have an idea.
Hey, what if we aim this way when we talk to people?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Maybe get up on stage.
Yeah, turn the speakers from the parking lot and aim them so the sound travels down that row of booths. At least a few people are milling around there. Done. Bob starts his speech saying he wants to acknowledge elected officials who have come. He says he'll call out the offices and ask them to pipe up for their applause.
So if there's anyone here from the U.S. Senate, we'd like to hear that. The House of Representatives, the Illinois State Senate, Mr. Forby's here, Illinois General Assembly, we got anybody?
They do not. No local officials either, no mayors, no nothing. Bob soldiers on through the rest of his speech. It's maybe 5 minutes.
If you hadn't signed up to be a member, come by the tent. Thanks, guys.
Afterwards, he gets himself a big cone of soft-serve ice cream as a reward. And frankly, he deserves it. By the time he got up on that stage, I'd seen he had already accepted defeat. He was really just gritting his way through it. So when I ask how he thinks it all went, of course, he puts a brave face on things.
It's good. It's good. It's always disappointing, and it can be frustrating, you know, not to have a bigger turnout as you want.
If Bob and Kelly hoped to find ground troops for their movement, their effort to stop the war on coal, they've gotten the message. There are not many troops left here. As one person even tells me later, this isn't coal country. Used to be, but not anymore. These days, Facebook is the perfect place to find what's left of that world. Memories, fierce pride, indignation, and lots of people itching to slag Barack Obama's climate change initiatives. But here, in West Frankfurt, with the jobs largely gone, what's left is mostly this. Carnival rides, funnel cake, dead grandparents you never even met. Earlier, Bob told me he had cleared his evening. He was planning to stick around till midnight at that booth, collecting signatures and email addresses, feeding the momentum he'd gotten a taste of. But not long after the rally flops, he and Kelly are at their Jeep. They're cutting off the decorations from the parade.
You guys really think you're getting ready to go?
Well, yeah, very shortly. Yeah.
Bob says they'll think about their next move later, like in a couple weeks. For now, they've got a houseboat on a little lake where they can relax, maybe forget this whole scene for a while. Dan Weissman, WBEZ.
That story comes to us from WBEZ's Heat of the Moment series. To hear more stories about everyday life on a changing planet, visit our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.